Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Forgotten California Murders 1915 to 1968 chronicles homicides that happened so long ago they have been forgotten even by the families of the killers and the victims. Their crimes are no less shocking than the murders that have had books and films made about them. The book that we're featuring this evening is Forgotten California Murders 1915 to 1968 with my special guest journalist and author, David Kolchek. Welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program. And thank you so much for this interview, David Kolchek.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dan.
Thank you so much. Once again, you've done it. Forgotten California Murders, some wild, wild stories here. Let's start off because we just take the time to just examine a few of these and explore somewhat in depth some of these wild stories that you've included in this of Forgotten California Murders. As we spoke before, let's talk about Dirty Wealthy Scoundrel, September 9th, 1933, Santa Cruz. As I mentioned, it just seems to be almost all of the kinds of things, the sensational things that we would find in a current case, yet 1933. Tell us about Dirty Wealthy Scoundrel.
Well, this case was really amazing just because of the level of people that were in high society in the San Francisco area. This guy named Francis Joseph Morgan Grace, he was the nephew of the guy who co-founded Grace Steamship Lines and the Panama Mail Steamship Company. So, you know, if you own steamships, especially back then, You were pretty wealthy.
Sure.
Yeah, he was raised in a lifestyle that rivaled European royalty. He was a member of all the clubs you could be members of in San Francisco. The Yacht Club, Burlingame Country Club, Santa Cruz Golf and Country Club, and the Bohemian Club. He was given a career as an executive in the family business, retired at 42. And because of the company he was involved in, him and his family got to travel anywhere in the world that they wanted to in luxury on their ships. He married the woman he married. She was from a famous California rich family. She was a descendant of David Colton, who was not only was he a Native American murderer, but he was also the attorney for the big four railroad barons, Sumter, Sanford, Hopkins, and Crocker. So you're talking mega bucks.
Yeah.
So they had a son, you know, one kid, he had married him off in 1930. And they were idle rich. You know, he was retired at 42. And they had a estate in Santa Cruz. And now where the area where their estate was is all houses and apartments and maybe a block from the ocean, right in Santa Cruz. I mean, you couldn't be more in the middle of Santa Cruz than this place. They called their place the Cabins. And their other place they lived at was the penthouse of the Alexander Hamilton Hotel in San Francisco. It's still there. So, you know, so these are, you know, the richest people in San Francisco. So this Grace guy, he was basically an alcoholic. He lived his life in alcoholic days. Told everyone he had a heart condition, was in ill health, but it was basically from a lifetime of heavy drinking. So on September 9th, 1933, Grace and his nurse, 28-year-old Helene Roberts, were walking through the extensive estate of the Cabins when his former nurse, 43-year-old Frieda Wilhelmina Augusta Welts, approached him. And after a short discussion, she pulled out a .32-caliber pistol and shot him in the chest. He made it to the door and slumped into the arms of his butler, who was a former guard of the Tsar in Russia. He disarmed the woman, called the police. Welts was all woozy, and she told the police that she had taken Lumina, which is a mild narcotic, and she was taken to the hospital, get her stomach pumped, and Grace was taken to the morgue. So she was fragile and quiet, and she said she only had her own reasons, and he didn't do what he promised to do. Their family shows up and stuff, and you know, goes to court. They're very properly represented by attorneys. One attorney came out from her hometown and outside of Philadelphia, or outside of Pittsburgh, and they also hired a Santa Cruz former district attorney, Sanford Smith, as co-counsel. So people right away you know, were interested in this case because it was, you know, rich people and his former nurse shooting him. But they really got into it once it came into court. And what happened was that she told the story on the stand. She kept it to herself until the day she went on the stand to report it. But she, on June 7th, 1932, while she was Grace's personal nurse, she drove him, or she accompanied him. They took the train from San Francisco to Santa Cruz. The only people at their Santa Cruz manor was the gardener and possibly somebody else. And he basically slipped her a Mickey, a date rape drug, in her drink, in her wine over dinner. And she woke up the next morning desperately sick, and she had bruises on her body, and she realized that she had been raped. And she was still too sick to get out of bed. So about 9 o'clock in the morning, Grace entered the bedroom, and she accused him of drugging and raping her. And he said it was true, and he laughed about it and told her she was a nurse and not to be able to take care of herself.
Right.
And she could not get out of bed that whole day. So she drove back. She got right back to San Francisco the next day. And after 6 weeks, she realized she was pregnant. And she told Grace her condition. He said that he would take care of her, but he never did. And as weeks went by, and she spoke to him, he suggested that she take a drug to abort the pregnancy.
Yeah.
So on August 21st, she took the drug, and she lost over 25 pounds and was weak and sick and wasn't able to work. she has grace for money so that she could rest without having to worry about paying her bills and things and recover from the effects of this chemical abortion. And Grace claimed that he was near poverty and gave her nothing. So she used her own money, went to Santa Cruz, and she stayed at a hotel that was behind his property on his back gate. And she'd see him out in his property. And so she planned on shooting herself in the head if he refused to help her. And of course, when it all happened, she ended up shooting him instead of shooting herself. Grace, before he was shot, he told her that a child out of wedlock would ruin her. And he demanded that she keep his promise to take care of the situation. So we have this did rich guy who drugged and raped his personal nurse and then wouldn't help her with recovering from the abortion or anything, or, you know, even wanting to help in any way. So, right. So they go on with this trial. She exposes everything. And this is, you know, Santa Cruz is very close to Carmel and Monterey, you know, where the rich have lived in California pretty much since it began. So, you know, these people were the high echelon of higher society. So they go, the 10 hours of deliberation, the jury came back and found her not guilty of the murder. And the crowd, they said, the Santa Cruz Sentinel said, feet pounded, hands clapped, and many cheered and whistled. And the foreman of the jury burst into tears and fell into the arms of Frida, and they both uncontrollably sobbed in each other's shoulders for two full minutes. So they were getting ready to fly back to Pennsylvania, and as they were getting onto the train to go to San Francisco to catch their plane back to Pittsburgh, Welts was secretly approached by one of the jury members, and he told her that he had been wounded in Flanders during World War I, and it was none other than Frida who had patched him up and tended his wounds while he waited to be transported to the front line. During World War I, she worked on the front lines as a nurse.
That's right, yeah. It was amazing, too, that so many people thanked her. You talk about a jury member said that he had been wounded in Flanders and it was none other than Welts that had tended to him. And when you talk about the lawyer, her attorney.
Oh, yeah.
He claimed to be, she had saved his son. So right. It's an extraordinary story where there was no way with her sympathetic story, despite not having any corroboration whatsoever, it really was why she was set free, because this was extraordinary circumstances where she had been such a hero to so many people, saved so many people's lives, and that was well documented. But just having two people so crucial to this trial, having been indebted to her and saying so, is an extraordinary end to this story. Incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, I found a lot while writing this book of cases where people got away with murder just because of the jury, you know, even though they were totally guilty and admitted it. I've got three or four chapters in this book where that happened.
You actually have a chapter called Getting Away with Murder.
Mm-hmm.
June 29th, 1954, Los Angeles. Philip Alm is a stuntman and film extra. And Andrew Ackerman, another character in this incredible story, is a stuntman and an extra as well. So they're involved in the film business. And you have Barbara Clampett, councilman, and this home with a swimming pool, and again, some opulence, and a character named Ed Neely. So tell us about this story, getting got away with murder, as you call it.
Yeah, this is 1954, and the daughters of Edward Clampett, who was a founding father of modern Los Angeles, and he helped develop the Los Angeles oil field and was involved in all that kind of stuff, was a city councilman for a while, belonged to all the great groups and things. He died in 1919, and his wife died about 8 years later, and left the whole fortune to his two daughters, Leah and Barbara. And Barbara married four times, Leah married six, and she was involved in the spouse swapping scandal. And she had an affair with film comedian Buster Keaton, which broke up his marriage and her marriage. And she managed to survive an airplane crash in there. So they lived in, Barbara lived in Wilshire neighborhood of Los Angeles, which is still very towny. It's a little south of Beverly Hills.
Okay.
And about noon, well, they were having their weekend party was still going on Monday. And, you know, this is 1954 in L.A., you know. The booze ran smoothly and no one got caught drunk driving. And so about noon, the Hollywood stuntman, Phil Alm, and his friend Andrew Ackerman showed up at Barbara's house in their swimwear to take a dip in Barbara's pool. And they pretty much had open house all weekend. So Alm was from Sweden. He was a captain in the Swedish Army and became a citizen in 1944 while serving in the U.S. Army. And he was in 1948's Joan of Arc, and he was in The Postman Always Rings Twice. He was in quite a few movies.
Right.
Even though he was Swedish, he had already lost his Swedish accent. He'd only been in the country like 20 years, and he had no accent. While they're at that house, this Neely guy, Ed Neely, he was a Texas oil man, kind of con artist, lived in California for decades, but he still had this brash East Texas accent, kind of like Foghorn Leghorn, the cartoon character. From the 50s and that. So he was Leah's sixth husband, and I believe it was his last. They were kind of giving each other crap about, you know, they were all drunk for days. And Neely was giving them grief about being a Swede. And, you know, they were razzing each other. And, you know, he's like, hey, at least I lost my accent. You still have a stupid Texas drawl. And they started needling each other about horses, guns, and Sweden and Texas. And Alm made a derogatory remark about Senator Joseph McCarthy. And that's when Neely got really mad, pulled out his gun, and shot him twice with a 9mm Italian pistol.
Mm-hmm.
So when the cops arrived, they found Alm stretched out in the living room rug, and the Clampett sisters and Ackerman were chatting and passing a bottle of vodka over his body. They arrested Neely and took Alm to the hospital. And days later, like almost a week later, Alm was in the hospital. He was recovering fine. And all of a sudden, he just collapsed and died while he was walking around in the corridor. And they couldn't, you know, they were like, wow, what happened? They figured it was a blood clot to his brain.
Right.
So they charged Neely with murder.
Mm-hmm.
The trial started on November 3rd, 1954, pretty quick, actually. And, you know, they got really good attorneys and kind of a lackluster prosecution, if you ask me. But Neely admitted to shooting him. And And Alm was, you know, awake and could describe the whole thing to police that happened. But Anili said it was in self-defense and that Alm was a real strong guy. He was, well, he was a stuntman, so I'm sure he was in great shape and everything.
Sure.
But they decided that he died not from being shot, but from a cerebral hemorrhage. And it's because they didn't, the coroner didn't do examine his brain during the autopsy, they never would know. So Neely got off the hook because of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, yeah, I think he got away with it. He was acquitted on November 15th, 1954. And that's like, there's another case where that kind of happened where this one happened in Fresno, California in 1966. And this guy shot his ex-wife and her boyfriend. And he was convicted of killing his wife, but not her boyfriend, who he shot with a shotgun. He shot them both with shotguns.
Right.
Because he had died from catching hepatitis with a blood transfusion. And they said he didn't die from actually being shot. He died from the from catching hepatitis with the blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
But he still got put away for killing his wife. But I never heard of that happening before until these cases.
Mm, interesting.
Where, you know, it's like, all right, you shoot somebody and then they catch something in the hospital. So you technically didn't kill them. That's what they said. I think now you would get convicted of murder from that.
Yeah. And I've seen cases where, you know, they might have thought that there was contributing factors outside of the assault, but however the person dies, so that you're responsible to a varying degree or a certain degree. So there's no way you're right. I think today you would not get an acquittal. That would be you would not get an acquittal.
Yeah.
You have another story called Little Black Book that just seems to have so many parallels with today. Today, we would be reading Instagram or Facebook messages or some sort of messages, text messages that would be recorded forensically. The police would be able to obtain them. But you have this Little Black Book story, November 25th, 1958, Orinder, Contra Costa County, William Roy Anderson, 60 years old, president of a collection agency, not so nice of a guy apparently, but he's a debt collector. So who likes the debt collector? So tell us about this Little Black Book and William Roy Anderson.
Well, William Anderson was 60 years old in 1958, and he was the president of a collection agency in downtown San Francisco. They were described, the Contra Costa Sheriff Inspector said they were hard-pounding, go-getting outfit, and they filed as many as 20 to 30 property liens a day against Bay Area debtors.
Mm-hmm.
So he was making pretty good money. Orinda is, I guess it always has been, a very upper-class place.
Mm-hmm.
It's just east of Oakland in San Francisco, just maybe 15 miles from downtown San Francisco or so. So he was married for 33 years, but he was a relentless womanizer. And his wife, she claimed to not know anything about his tomcatting ways or anything. And so on November 25th, 1958, they were relaxing in their separate bedrooms around 9 o'clock. The doorbell rang and Anderson answered the door. He overheard, his wife overheard him say, "You've got the wrong Roy Anderson." And she heard a gunshot. And she found him laying in the doorway dead. Someone fired a .22 caliber bullet through the screen door and directly into his heart. Mm-hmm. And killed him. So they found a spent shell. The bullet went right through him, and he never did find the bullet. Maybe fell down a furnace vent or something like that after it came out of Anderson. But they don't know. So while they were searching his belongings, they found a note in his suit jacket that he had worn that day, and it said, "Open in case of emergency." And he just had contact numbers and stuff like that, you know, in case something happened to him. And then they found an identical envelope in his dresser drawer.
Okay.
And he was just oddly that he was reading at his bedside a mystery novel called Two Deaths Must Die. So probably didn't know how quick that was going to happen. So the police also found this little black book, and it had cryptic entries in it that covered over 10 years of notes to one woman. And there were names of a dozen other women in the book, some without addresses or phone numbers, and just dates for him to remember. The police tracked down all these people, and 7 of the 15 women lived in the same apartment building in San Francisco.
Wow. Yeah.
Which is really odd.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the cops thought, oh, there's a, you know, a jealous partner, you know, husband or something, or, you know, it could be a disgruntled debtor. They spoke to his business partner, and he said that Anderson was nervous the day of his murder. And he confided in him that between the devil and deep blue sea, his only solution was to go to Mexico. And he didn't really know what he meant about it. You know, he said, "We're in a rough and tumble business full of angry and disgruntled people with frayed tempers and ruined lives." And he goes, "As far as I know, Roy had no enemies. We've been punched in the mouth, but never shot at before." The police were curious about this one guy named Lawrence Swinicki, who had worked for him and had cashed some checks that were for the company into his own private, embezzled, basically. And they thought that he might have had something to do with it, because they filed federal charges on him. But it turned out that he was living in Pennsylvania with his brother, and he was just waiting for his sentencing. So there's another employee, 25-year-old secretary Retha Maxine Parks Filiberti, and the police discovered that she and Anderson spent November 21st through the 23rd at a Holiday Hotel in Reno. And she told the officers that she accompanied them on many overnight trips to Sacramento, Santa Rosa, Santa Cruz, as well as Reno. They did a little more digging, and they found out that Anderson was paying her rent at her apartment in San Francisco. And she was also the beneficiary of a $25,000 life insurance policy that Anderson had.
Yeah.
So she admitted to the affair, and said that Anderson told her that he was having an affair with someone for over 10 years and was going to break up with her, and that he had two other girlfriends. And at the same time, you know, his wife was unaware of any of this. So, you know, they could not get anywhere on the case. Mm-hmm. They didn't, you know, there's too many people involved in it. And some mystery people showed up in their town asking for them, and, you know, nothing came of that or anything either. So, you know, no one knows who killed Roy Anderson. It could have been an angry debtor, a jealous boyfriend or husband from one of his many lovers. It could have been one of his lovers or former lovers. It could have been a paid hit. It could have been his wife. Could have been a case of mistaken identity. And according to San Francisco Examiner columnist Dan Frischman, there were 113 other William or Roy Andersons in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Incredible. I thought that was one of the most incredible. Because he said, when we go back to the beginning of the story, that he answered the door and overheard, his wife overheard them say, "You got the wrong Roy Anderson."
Yeah.
So, with 113 of them. And at the end of your story, it just adds a lot of credence to the idea that, well, maybe it was a mistaken identity.
Yeah. Yeah. No one will ever know. It's been over 60 years and it's been unsolved.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. My regular listeners to the program know that I'm obsessed with playing Best Fiends all year round, but I really love playing Best Fiends during the holidays. It's a perfect pick-me-up and a break from all the holiday activities. I can't get enough of Best Fiends. It has to be the best puzzle game anywhere. No Wi-Fi? No problem. Play Best Fiends whenever and wherever you want with offline mode. I'm pretty far along now at level 380, but really, Best Fiends has thousands of levels and even more added constantly. Always a fresh challenge for me when I need to recharge mentally. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, David, we were talking about another interesting story and called Spare the Rod. So let's talk about that.
That was a horrible, horrible case. You know, it makes you wonder sometimes why people have kids this is one of those stories that makes you just wonder what happened here. And what happened is on January 7th, 1958, his family lived in a two-room cottage. Father Claude Schindler was a farm worker. He was picking cotton at the moment. His wife, Opal, they had known each other since they were kids. This is in Red Top in Madrid County, in the San Joaquin Valley, where everything is grown, you know. They were devout Baptists, and they read the Bible every night to their five children, but they didn't always attend church because, you know, he had to work on Sundays quite often and stuff. It was about 13 miles west of Chowchilla. So on January 7th, Claude wasn't feeling well, and he stayed home. And a 4-year-old Sandra, his daughter, started acting up, and instead of sending her room or something, 27-year-old Opal started beating her with a belt for 5 to 10 minutes. So Claude was napping on the couch and woke up from all the noise and took over from where she let off. Mm-hmm. So he beat her with switches broken off from a tree in the front of the house. And when one switch broke, wore out, he'd send Opal out for another one. After a while, they were out of her reach and she couldn't grab them. So he used a leather strap and continued beating her. They beat her for 45 minutes. So when they were done beating her, they gave her a shower and they hit her a couple more times with the belt, and they put salve on her wounds and dressed her. And an hour later, she just dropped dead. And they tried praying over her body and nothing happened. So they walked over and called the police. And now this is in 1958.
Right.
Four 911 operators were trained. And they called the police, and the operator told them to take her to a doctor. Yeah. And by the time they got her to the doctor, she already had rigor mortis. They took her body to a funeral home for an autopsy, and Claude and Opal were arrested. The rest of their kids, they had a 3-year-old daughter and three sons, were 5, 2, and 8 months, and they were all put into foster homes. The children were examined. They were all covered with bruises and cuts and various states of healing. The police were just sickened by what they saw. There were bloodstained switches were broken, were laid all over the house and their yard. So the people of Red Tree, which is really just it's like a gas station, that's it, and an intersection in between these, you know, tomato fields or whatever. The landlord, the guy who owned the property, was so shocked, and he had known them since they were both children. And after the police were done taking photos, he had the house burned and the surrounding trees bulldozed over 3 days after the murder.
Right.
So he razed the buildings to return the site to good, clean farm dirt again.
Jeez.
So the guy who did the coroner, the autopsy, was this guy named Zednik Flus, who was a former refugee from Czechoslovakia during the Nazi occupation. Mm-hmm. He said it was the most vicious thing he ever seen. He didn't see anything worse under the Hitler regime. And they said they counted more than 200 welts, bruises, and slashes on Sandra's body.
Incredible.
Yeah, just incredible. Claude and Opal were let out of jail to attend the funeral, but they were arraigned for murder later that day. And the trial was postponed multiple times. And, the courtroom was packed, of course, and they showed the slides of the dead child. And, you know, it was very sickening. Colored slides of her, of the little kid's body, all bruised and battered and stuff. Since she was said over 200 times, she died of internal bleeding and shock. So they had their kid, their 6-year-old son, take the witness stand to testify against his parents.
Extraordinary.
And he said that they switched Sandra because she messed at the breakfast table. Then he said father hit the sister with a belt, then switches again, then the belt again. So the Schindlers actually went up and testified, which was, you know, now a pretty bright thing. Claude testified that he beat his daughter because he believed she was possessed by the devil and that God commanded him to correct the children in that manner. And he would beat her until she would mind. He said, I was raised the same way with a rod and had whipping on my own body. So his wife goes up there and she tells the court, first time I ever heard of a whipping hurting a child.
Jesus.
I didn't think it could kill it. And she explained why she was beaten. And she said she was different from the other children. She had the mind of a 12-year-old. So they were both convicted of second-degree murder and were sentenced to 5 years to life. Opal fought the conviction, got a new trial, and she pled guilty and was resentenced to 1 to 10 years and was paroled just within 6 months. She went and lived with her sister in Chalchella. Claude died in 1997, and Opal died in 2009. And little Sandra would have been about 67 years old, and she lived.
It's fascinating, though, that manslaughter was reduced to manslaughter under these horrendous conditions, and she was paroled in 1961. So, again, it's hard to believe that they would have that. The public outcry was extraordinary. And the particulars of the case are thankfully rare, and yet, you know, given some time, parole and manslaughter, 1 to 10. So, very interesting outcome in that particular case, certainly.
Yeah. Back in those days, if you had like second degree murder, the basic sentence was 5 years to life. Mm-hmm. And usually they got out in about 7 or 8 years.
Oh, so, really? Well,
yeah. Yeah, that was basically it. After the 80s or so, you got 15 to life, and people were usually let out after about 18 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
All right.
Now, you have another story called AWOL Marines Up to No Good, September 9th, 1956, Orland, Glenn County. And you have character Kenneth Nielsen, 20-year-old, and patrolman Charles Smith and Everett Harkey. Harkey's a corporal at 23. Let's talk about this Camp Pendleton, absent from leave, U.S. Marine Corps, and this story in Contra Costa County, and the police. This interesting story with these two Marines and some police.
Yeah, this one is kind of like my favorite story. I don't know why, maybe because I've been in the Orland area, which is about an hour north of Sacramento where I live. In the farmland, you know, it's they grow olives and almonds and stuff up there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, 1956, this 23-year-old corporal, Everett Harkey, and a 20-year-old private, Ken Johnson or Nelson, were absent without leave from Camp Pendleton. And they were both from the Bay Area. So, Harkey was from Oakland and Nelson was from Martinez, which is right outside of San Francisco.
Yeah.
So they were hitchhiking and they had robbed a store earlier to get some money. And so they were hitchhiking up north and they got a lift from this guy named Robert Lowry. He was a salesman or something. He wasn't sure about these hitchhikers, especially when Nelson flashed a pistol when Lowry asked about the dangers of hitchhiking. So he ditched his passengers in Willow, which is, you know, a little field town, little farm town, and checked in a hotel for a night. So those guys, they stole Lowry's car. They saw there was a spare key in the glove box.
Mm-hmm.
So after they left, he went into the hotel. They just got the car and took off. He didn't even know for like 6 hours that the car was stolen. So Nelson drove. They drove up Highway 99. It's still there. It's like I-5 and 99. They kind of connect in some places, but for the most part, they're separate highways still. So they were speeding through these little towns, Blue Gum and Arturas, blowing through those towns at 100 miles an hour, zigzagging through the heavy traffic. It was a Sunday, and there was an unusual amount of traffic on the freeway that day, or on the highway that day. These were just two-lane roads with maybe a lane in the middle to turn. Of course, this cop sees that this guy, a cop named Officer Charles Smith, and it takes him a while before he catches up with them because they're going 100 miles an hour in traffic. So he's behind them, and this guy was California Highway Patrol officer for about 6 years, and was a MP in the military before that, and was an outstanding officer. So he pulls over these people. These guys in front of Dixie Lee White's trailer house, and she was just doing her ironing that evening and just kind of keeping an eye out on traffic because there were so many different kinds of cars and trucks going down. You know, it was just kind of something to do out there. There was no TV or anything back then. So right in front of her house, the cop pulls over the car with the two men inside. And the officer got out and spoke to them. He had Harkley step out of the car, frisked him, went back to his car. He was suspicious that the car was stolen, but of course it wasn't reported yet because the car didn't know that it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So Smith walked back to the car with his ticket book. And as he approached the driver's side, Nelson was driving, and Nelson jumped out and shot Officer Smith four times with a 25 caliber semi-automatic pistol. Smith staggered, turned around, and fell to the ground. But using all of his strength, Officer Smith lurched to the driver's side of the car before Nelson could put it into gear to take off, and fired his service revolver. And at the same time, Nelson managed to squeeze off one more shot, hitting Smith in the shoulder. But Smith just let loose, just pulled the trigger as much as he could. And a millisecond before Nelson's bullet hit the officer, the officers blew out his brains, right there. He fired three more shots, and the bullet hit Hockley in the left hand and in the left side of his head, killed him too. Then Smith stumbled back between the two cars and fell on his face. That lady, Dixie, she grabbed the phone and called the highway patrol, but they were already there. He had already, called it in on the radio and stuff. But just such a crazy, crazy shootout, leaving three people dead on the side of the highway.
Yeah, and it was one big funeral event, wasn't it, with law enforcement in full force. It was a big event, this funeral, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of the first times. And now it's kind of common that when a police officer dies, that police agencies send a representative or two to their funeral. And this was one of the first times that I can tell that police departments from all over California sent representatives to show their respect to the fallen officer.
Mm-hmm.
He was only 26 years old.
Wow. Let's talk about one chapter you call Shotgun Slaying, or one story, Shotgun Slaying, October 17th, 1966 in Fresno.
Yeah,
California.
I already talked a little bit about that because that's the one where this guy named Henry Anderson had a hard knock life. He was just born poor, and his father died when he was a kid, and he was in Korea, and got in trouble with the law. His brother, sister, another brother, and his mother all died within 5 years. And he just knocked around from one low-paying job to another. And he got married to this Sharon Walker in June 1965. And the relationship only lasted until December of 66. She was originally from Oklahoma, but lived in Fresno since she was a kid. And She had a son from a previous marriage that that lived with her. So she had a job and stuff, and she dated, and she was divorced from Henry.
Mm-hmm.
But Henry had a hard time that the marriage failed. And they had little bickering things that happened where he accused her of smashing his windshield and trying to pry open a glove box. And she showed up at his apartment once early in the morning and started arguing with him. And he ended up pushing her in the swimming pool. And the DA's office back then, they said that the district attorney's office does not issue restraining orders. And they were told that they were not acting like adults and could avoid any future conflict by just staying away from each other. This is in 1966.
Yeah, geez. Eh?
So Henry was like 30 years old. He was taking pills and drinking to excess. And on the day that this happened, October 17th, 1966, he figured he had drank 40 screwdrivers, vodka and orange juice, took some non-narcotic pills, and had not eaten in the entire day.
Wow. So
he called Sharon. She was 29, and she told him she had company. And so the guy she was seeing was this guy, 40-year-old businessman. He was in Fresno on business, only arrived a few hours before. Henry came walking over to her house, went through the back door about 10:30 at night, and shot this guy, Kenneth Quant, in the chest with a bolt-action 12-gauge shotgun. He just walked in through the back door, right into the kitchen, just shot him. And Sharon, who was clad in a red negligee, ran out of the house through the front door, and he gunned her down the driveway with two blasts of a shotgun. The whole time, her four-year-old son was sleeping in the bed. So this Quant guy, he was a large landowner in Kings County, and he sold out in 1963, got like millions of dollars for his property. You know, there's oil, it was oil property over in Kings County and stuff. It's around Bakersfield. And he had moved to Chico in Northern California, and dabbled in real estate and was a gentleman farmer. And he was married and had four kids. So a couple of weeks before the murder, Henry talked to Quant's wife by telephone and threatened to kill Quant if he didn't stop seeing Sharon.
Right.
So the police found the 12-gauge was right in the neighbor's yard, and Anderson ran off to Sacramento and laid low for about a week, till he turned himself in with his brother helping him. So this Quant guy died in the hospital from hepatitis. That's what I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
He caught from a blood transfusion. And so Anderson was charged with that death, but it was dropped because Quant's death was from hepatitis and not from the shotgun blast.
Incredible.
That was like so weird. Yeah. So, he tried to plead guilty by reason of insanity, and they said that he knew what he was doing. They sentenced him to 5 years to life in prison, and he died in prison in 1972.
Yeah, he lasted 5 years.
Yeah, died in 5 years in prison.
Yeah, interesting. You have other stories like Pioneer Road Rage and Unwritten Law. Another story called A Favor, The White Hibiscus, She Missed, and a story called Young Murderer. Tell us about another story that particularly interested you out of this particularly interesting collection.
Well, thanks. I think the Pioneer Road Rage, this is the first instance of road rage, fatal road rage that I've ever come across, 1921. So, you know, that's very, very early in cars. And these two couples were riding around in this car that was had a cracked frame and was running rough. And, you know, 1921, you think about how primitive cars were in 1921.
Sure.
The guy's mechanic said to drive it slowly. So, and this is on a Sunday night, shortly before midnight at the corner of 24th and M Street, which is right in Midtown Sacramento. This guy named Albert Pappy cut them off, causing McShane to swerve and like bump into the curb. They shouted out to each other and something like they claim, like, where the hell did you get that stuff, implying he was drunk. And Pappy supposedly responded by calling them some vile names and invited him to follow him when he sped up. I don't know how that could happen if he was just driving by and like they almost collided.
Sure.
They didn't stop and talk, you know. So this machine guy, he drove after Pappy driving down M Street the wrong way. It's a two-way street, and he was driving in the opposite lane to catch up with him. So this Pappy guy, he was a house painter, and he had promoted a dance that night with a friend, and it was like almost midnight, and he had the receipts from the dance, and he had just dropped off his partner, and he was driving to his house, which was like on L Street, when you know, he almost collided with the car, and he didn't think about it. He just drove on, and when he pulled up into the space in front of his house, the McShane was following him, pulled up behind him, and they jumped out of the car. And like Pappy saw like a guy running towards him that the car stopped, and he thought he was getting robbed, you know, because he had the receipts from this dance and stuff. So he grabbed this anti-theft device that was basically a pipe that stuck in the spokes of the tire.
Right.
And, remember the club that you used to put on your shirt? Yeah. And he hit Beale, the passenger, over the head with it.
Right.
And left. The guy's wife ran up to him, and he like shoved her. He didn't know what was going on. He just wanted to get out of there. And they took him to a doctor. His friends took him to a doctor. They wrapped his head and put him in the hospital. He got an infection, and he died. Now, he was like a college-educated bank teller who grew up across the street from the Sanford Mansion in Sacramento, which is like a state historical building now. Across the street's like office buildings and stuff now. But, you know, that was a pretty exclusive neighborhood back then. So he had some, you know, connections and stuff. So they held this guy, Pappy, without bail. They got him to get the charge reduced to manslaughter, and they got a bond for it. They basically said, you know, they said that, oh, he endangered them, and but they wouldn't explain why they drove off after him. And and no one saw him striking the Beale guy. There's a lot of people out. You know, it's kind of funny because you read these articles and it's like, say some ice cream shop was robbed at 1 a.m. You know, these places stayed open. Like,
wow.
You know, is because, you know, for every article, for every chapter I write, there's two that I don't. That just don't make the cut. So, you know, it's just pretty weird. Pappy's neighbors and friends and stuff all called up and said about how he was, you know, a great citizen and you know, contributed to the neighborhood and stuff. And he was acquitted. And
extraordinary.
Yeah. He went on to live to be 85 years old.
Yeah, extraordinary. There was some good attorneys and some good lawyering in almost most of these cases that you have written about and featured in this book. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Forgotten California Murders, 1915 to 1968. Thanks for reviving our memory about these murders. For those that might want to take a look at other work, the other books that you've written about California murders, how might they do that, David?
Well, they're all on Amazon. You can get them. I have a Amazon page, author page, and there's my six books there. Yeah, my six books that I've had published. No, actually seven. So you can get it through Amazon, or you could order it through any bookstore. And hopefully this will, it's only been out about 3 weeks now. So nice. it's just brand new.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Forgotten California Murders, 1915 to 1968. It's, as always, fascinating. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, and good night.
His karate lessons might not turn him into a black belt.
Hi-ya!
And even after band camp, he might not be the greatest musician. But with the 3% annual percentage yield you can earn on a PenFed Premium Online Savings Account, your goal of supporting his dreams...
Thanks for everything, Mom and Dad.
...will always be worth it. Apply today at PenFed.org/savings. Federally insured by NCUA. $5 minimum to open account. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed.
PenFed's got great rates for everyone.